My name is Walton. I'm an alcoholic. Guys, you know what a terrible place this is to be in to try to follow all these speakers this weekend. My sobriety date is February the 13th of 1976, and I'll be eternally grateful for a little guy from Cleveland, Ohio, who managed to carry this message to me where I could understand it. I used to say he was the most important person I've ever known in my life. He shares equal billing today with a little gal about this tall. Her name is Neva. She's been my wife for 28 years. She's finally elevated herself to equal billing with the guy that 12-stepped me. And it hadn't been easy. I don't know how you felt about the person that got you here, but I had him pretty high up on the list of people in my life. He still is. I want to thank Jay and the committee and everybody involved here. I've had the opportunity to sit back and for the last 3 or 4 days and watch Alcoholics Anonymous at work at its best, at its very best. You know, this is just my feeling. The people like me who have the opportunity to do this on occasion are the icing on the cake. The cake is over there in the corner. The people in the trenches that put together these things that work tirelessly for a year, sometimes 2 years to put one of them on, I think deserve a large hand. I got up this morning, and to show you how often I wear this suit, apparently the last time I wore it was in Thanksgiving of last year. I put my hand in my pocket. I thought, well, I don't want to remember, because you know you get as old as I am, guys. Your memory's almost gone. I want to thank Mike and Eric and Barbara and Angie for the beautiful job they did here sharing their stories this weekend. I reached in there. I was going to write their names down because, you know, it's really be embarrassing to get up here and forget somebody's name. And I found this list of little things that I had from last Thanksgiving. Jay and I were on doing a deal together. He was there by the request of the committee. I came as a substitute. This morning I'm here as the request of the committee. Nobody died or anything bad happened. So I got here on my own merits today, and I want to thank Jay for asking me to come here and share my story with you. I've been up since about 4:30 this morning trying to remember all of Clancy's story. Or maybe Jim Williams from Fort Worth. Those of you remember Jim. Maybe Jack Sullivan's story. Because mine just does not seem to have the punch that I've heard here this weekend. So I thought, you know, but I'm stuck with this story, and unfortunately so are you this morning. But I would like to tell you this, and I mean this in very sincere. I can be a little arrogant, I suppose, today, and I don't mean this to be that way at all. I know, I think somebody else said it here earlier this weekend, that there will be some people, one or two of you, maybe three or four, maybe half of you, I don't know, will go away from here today saying, wonder why Jay asked that guy to come talk. My goal is this morning is the same one that Renee Towsley had with me in 1976, is to communicate to somebody in this room the miracle that can take place in your life if you decide to follow a few simple suggestions. That's my only purpose here today. My purpose is here to hopefully there be some one person in this building that's maybe struggling with the idea of that next drink like most of us did most of our lives, to hear something or to feel something that's shared here this morning in this room that you can take out of here and maybe prevent taking that next drink or that next hit of outside issue, whichever you may be involved with. That's what we call them in Mississippi. It makes the old timers happy. Don't come in here talking about no dope. Guy told me, a very good friend of mine passed away, and Buddy still had his sheriff's badge when he died. I turned mine in about 15 years ago. I got real uncomfortable being the caretaker of Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody elected me to be sheriff. I just got up one morning and put it on and said, I'm straight. Very undemocratic policy. But I'd come to your group and tell you, you know, you're not doing this right. And needless to say, over a period of time, I wasn't the most popular guy in AA. What a relief it is that I don't have to do that anymore. And Buddy H. that died in was a very active member in AA, did a lot of good stuff, and he had asked me to go to a retreat to speak one time with him, and we got in a long conversation in the car going there, and he said, I know that you have more tolerance for these young people coming in here with their profanity and coming in here with their dual addictions than I do. And I said, thank God to that for myself, you know, and I said, Buddy, I'm going to tell you something. If it was not for the third tradition, there's a very good chance I would have died drunk. There's a very strong possibility that you wouldn't be seeing me this morning. And Buddy told me, he said, I don't like them people coming in there talking about drugs for a whole hour. And I agreed 100% with him. But I'd like to add something to that. I don't like to go to a meeting where they talk about drinking for a whole hour either. So as long as we can come together and stay in a common solution and leave our and-does at the door, as most of us choose to do, it's a beautiful thing. I had a conversation with a young man the other night on the pier. I have not seen him in 15 years. Paul and Christy, and I met some more of his friends from Ohio. Paul had been sober for 2 months when I was with him in 1992. And they let an old guy, me, hang out with a bunch of young people in AA. As a matter of fact, it was a young people's deal. And saw Paul for the first time in 15 years. He's still sober. And he and I shared some things the other night on the end of that pier about the freedom in Alcoholics Anonymous. And eventually, see, when I came here, guys, I don't know about you, I didn't come out of a prayer meeting in here. I came off the streets, and I was a born hustler, and I ran with a lot of people. Angie last night, you know, I've grown past profanity most of the time, but I have to be honest with you, I still love to cuss. I hadn't cheated on my wife in 28 years. I stopped smoking November the 17th of 1985. I hadn't had any alcohol in me since February the 13th of 1976. Please allow me to do something bad, will you? But I'm not going to do it this morning. That little situation in the cafeteria a while ago tempted me. Got through that okay. I want to tell a story this morning, and it's two stories, really. It's my story, and then it becomes our story. And believe me, our story is a lot more interesting than my story is. Our story started February the 13th of 1976. But I'll give you a little bit of mine before we get to that place. I wondered several times about my mother and dad. They were both great people. They chose to go their separate ways when I was 12 years old. But earlier than that, you know, we lived in a very rural area in northeast Arkansas. Matter of fact, we lived on a dirt road. And one year I got a pair of roller skates for Christmas. I never could figure out what in the world they gave me them skates for. You know, I got up in my teenage years, people said, do you skate? I said, no, I have some, but I don't skate. So, you know, I wanted to be hip, slick, and cool when I was 5 or 6 years old. I don't know about y'all, but I come from the cool era. You know, I mean, if you weren't cool, I mean, matter of fact, I was so cool, you'd have to wear an overcoat to get close to me sometimes. And speaking of that, I'm not as cool as I usually like to be when I get up here. I can always use the excuse the sun's bright, but to put the finishing touches on being cool, you got to wear your shades. I mean, that's hell, you know. Whoever saw anybody cool didn't have dark glasses. So, you know, I started wearing shades when I was a long time before that, you know, Foster Grant was a big deal. But anyway, when I started growing up, to be cool was the thing. I listened to Barbara talk about coming from a Jewish background. Now, I'm born in Northeast Arkansas, and there were probably maybe two Jewish families within 100 miles of us. And about 6 or 7 years old, I thought, you know, I got my texture, my hair resembles some of their family. Got this. And I began to wonder. I said, I may be Jewish. And I really thought that. I said, you know, because I always felt like there was just a little something not quite center with me. And then I heard Angie talk last night. She was talking about her white family. There was a radio station in Gallatin, Tennessee. Must have been an 8 million megawatt station. You could hear it on the moon. I'm sure they heard Randy's record shop when they landed on the moon from Gallatin, Tennessee. And I'm a little white guy in Northeast Arkansas. The whole world's listening to Hank Williams Sr. and a lot of those Grand Ole Opry people, and it just didn't quite ring my bell for me. So I turned that radio on at night when everybody was asleep, and I'd get Randy's record shop from Gallatin, Tennessee, and he was playing nothing but blues and what's today known as rock and roll. And then they started playing black spiritual music. There was a woman named Sister Rosetta Tharpe that sang Every Day or something similar to that, and I used to just get goosebumps on me. Well, I went from that as I progressed and became a teenager and a young adult to where, you know, I missed the whole Elvis Presley era. I lived in the town where he was born. People say, what'd you think about Elvis? I said, I don't remember a whole lot about it. Because Elvis was not cool to me. I mean, the only cool musicians in the world, I got focused on jazz at a real early time in my life. Can't play anything, can't sing. Don't expect any vocals this morning because there ain't going to be one. But I got wound up in all of that, and the more I got into that music and that culture, the cooler I got. And I got so cool sometimes I'd have to put extra cover on me at night. And just was a very important for me to be the coolest guy in the world. It's hard to be cool when you're 73 years old, I'm going to tell you that. You know, I saw me before I put this suit on this morning. That ain't the coolest sight you want to look at. Even with the, I had these shades on too. You know, my parents did a great job with me. They just didn't know what to do with me. I found my first drink when I was 14 years old. Not my first drink, my first drunk. I'd had a sip of wine here and a sip of wine there on family gatherings and maybe a sip of beer or two. And but I sat on the back of a flatbed truck and a little rise in a Crawley's Ridge in Northeast Arkansas with a guy that was just like a brother to me. And we shared two bottles of 95-cent fifth wine. And I did exactly what they talked about earlier this weekend. I drank it as quick as I could, and I felt so good I could not believe how good I felt for about 20 minutes. And I had my first near-death experience for the next 3 days after that. I don't recall ever being that sick in my life before or since. So, you know, if intelligence has anything to do with whether we pick up that next drink or not, You know, I was very well. I was extremely aware how sick I couldn't move. And somewhere about the second day, that thought came back. You remember that 20 minutes you had the other night? And I said, "Yeah, boy, wasn't it something?" So I thought, "You got to try that again." So I spent from the time I was 14 years old till I was 18 learning how to lengthen those periods of feel good and shorten them periods of feeling bad. And by the time I was 18 or 19 years old, I could pretty much walk that line, you know, without tipping over. Every now and then I would. I was a kid that was, they say I was pretty gifted as an athlete. I could probably elaborate on that because they're all, most of them are dead now to refute the story. I could probably get up here and tell you that I was really something other than what I was, but I was an average guy. But athletics meant a great deal to me. Academics meant something to me. Not as much as athletics did at that age, but I was always afraid that sobering up was going to take something away from me, and I failed to realize for a number of years that the moment that I began to drink alcoholically, I started giving up things of value from day one. I started surrendering stuff that had great meaning to me. And sometimes when that stuff's going away from us, we don't necessarily notice it at the time that it leaves. But it's going nevertheless. So at 14, the games that I played, which were most of them, my ability to focus on what I was doing and my willingness to prepare myself to play those games began to diminish. So needless to say, by the time I was 17 years old, what could have been probably a free ticket to a university or a small college for sure went out the window, because I put a greater priority on the desire to drink and the desire to do and be who I wanted to be with who I wanted to be with. It's funny how life changed. When I was a young guy, I hung out with older people. Now I'm an old guy that hangs out with primarily younger people. There's got to be a message in that somewhere, don't you think? Anyway, the giving up process began, and when I was 42 years old, I came to you. And every principle, every ideal, everything of value that pertained to being a decent human being was gone. And I could not find the drink that would make it okay. See, I woke up a lot of days in my life, as I'm sure probably many of you did, feeling that guilt and remorse and how did I do this again? And the fear that went with it. The book talks about, you know, we do some stuff that, when we sober up, we're just terrified that somebody might know about it. I don't know about you, but alcohol did a strange thing for me. I got invisible when I drank a lot. I'd go do stuff in places, you know, with people I didn't have any business being with and expect nobody to see me. And then the next day I'd get a call, you know. Who was that woman you was with last night? Not me. I wasn't even there. You know, lying just became a way of life for me. There were a couple things that are pretty funny about some things that happened to me in my drinking life. I've been to Skid Row. My wife always tells me, she's, God bless her, we live in a small community, and she's been so fearful. She was raised there. And when we moved there, after we'd been married 5 years, she was so fearful that my story was going to get out in the community and would absolutely just destroy our reputation. Here's where you deserve a great deal of credit, as well as the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in general. I've never been reluctant to share any part of my story from here or one-on-one or in a closed meeting since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. To my knowledge, as of this day, right now, my trust has never been misused with you. It has never come back to me and said, well, I heard all about that guy. I heard about him. Nobody out there in the whatever the normal world is has ever come to me and said, you know, I heard some bad stuff about you. So when we moved to Tupelo, Mississippi, where she'd been her home, where she grew up, where she knew people, where she'd had a life without me, and she'd say, you know, is it necessary? She told me before I came down here, she said, is it going to be necessary for you to do that? So I'm going to try not to talk about the penitentiary or the nut house this morning. Or being on Skid Row. I'm just going to let you know that I've been there. And I'd also like to tell you that I did not like any of those places. But I'm going to tell you something else. My life got so bad sober. My life got so bad drinking on the street that I have literally wished, maybe thought, man, it'd be good to go back to the joint again. It would be good to get back inside. I wouldn't have all these people pulling on me. I wouldn't have all these decisions to make. I wouldn't be doing all this crazy stuff because I'd have somebody running my life. That's how bad alcoholism got to me as a free man. One of my experiences on the street is has to do with maybe some former athletic ability. I was living on the beach in Santa Monica, California, not in a house. I was living on the beach in Santa Monica, California. I saw a guy down here day before yesterday slapping at some flies on him. I knew exactly what was wrong with him. Man, them fleas will eat you up at night on the beach. Sure, go down there and sleep for a night or two. I'd been sleeping on that beach, and I'd get up in the morning, and I'd go stand on the corner of Ocean Avenue and Wilshire Boulevard or Santa Monica Boulevard. I'd stand there, and I still had my shades. I might be on a skid row, but I still had them glasses. And I could still look cool and purposeful. I'd stand on the corner like I was waiting for a ride to go to work. Looking like I had to look. You know, everybody else around me, you could just see the purpose in their life. They're going somewhere that has some meaning to it. And all I'm doing is trying to kill a little time till I can go hustle me something to get another drink. So I'm standing there one morning, and I wanted a cigarette so bad. Woman walked up, nicely dressed, going to work, pulled out a pack of Herbert Territon cigarettes. This is the day before Virginia Slims, and I swear the cigarette was this long. And lit it, and I hadn't had one probably 24 hours. And it was before I still had enough false pride left not to ask for one, so she lit that cigarette up, and I heard a diesel engine coming, and I thought, the bus is coming. You know how we think quick. The bus is coming. She can't smoke on the bus. So I played as a receiver in football, and I got in the best position I could get, my wide-out stance. And the bus came around the corner. She took one final drag off of it. And I know most of you guys, maybe some of you ladies here this morning, have watched NFL films. Everything is in half or three-quarter motion. She thumped that Herbert Territon, lipstick shining on one end of it. And it went end over end, seemed like for 10 minutes. And I could read the label, the name of the cigarette on it. And as it came down, I caught it about that far from the curb and came up smoking. Cool as I wanted to be. And then I noticed everybody on the bus was looking. But you know what? I didn't care. Got that smoke, man. Got that smoke. I had another bright idea one time. I ran into a guy, and I'd been in Phoenix, Arizona on one of my trips. I used to take a lot of trips. Always went west. If I ever get drunk again, I'm coming east. It's all pretty. But I wound up in a little town called Gila Bend, Arizona. And I can tell by looking at you, none of you have ever been there. Don't go. Don't go. Anyway, I wound up there, and the reason I went to Gila Bend was I met another guy I know today. He was an alcoholic. I met him, and he started telling me about this big, huge ranch he had. They don't have acreage out there. They deal in sections. He had a 4 or 5 section ranch. I met him in Phoenix. He had some money and was getting on a drunk. I didn't have any money. I was getting off of one. So we became instant friends. Wound up in Gila Bend with him, and I noticed he was a little uncomfortable the closer we got there about this ranch that he had. He didn't have a ranch. He had a room about as big as this table. And it was on the side of the Southern Pacific Railroad. And the room wasn't big enough for both of us, so I slept in the back of his truck. And my premise for going there was, is at the time, in my mind, I was a world champion duck caller. I grew up calling ducks with my dad, who incidentally wasn't a very good caller. And I thought, and I told him, I said, you know, I've probably won 2 or 3 championships. I don't remember which ones they were, but as good as I am, if I didn't, I should have won them. And I said, you own all that land out there in Gila Bend. We could dam up one of those. They don't call them gullies like we did in Mississippi. They call them arroyos. We could dam up one of those arroyos or hundreds of acres of water. We're close enough to the Pacific Flyway in California. You know, we get them ducks coming out of California into Gila Bend, Arizona. I'm calling them, selling memberships. There's no end to what we can do with this deal. Now, you know, when I got to step 2 in AA, I didn't have no problem with it. None. So I must have been doing a pretty good job because I convinced him it was a good idea and he didn't even own this land. So here I am in Gila Bend, Arizona with a guy named was Bill. I wonder if often, I hope he made it. I hope he made it to us because he needed to be. And, you know, something was brought to my attention. The annual rainfall in Gila Bend, Arizona is 2 inches a year. Kind of blew that flooding them arroyos story out the window pretty quick. That's kind of the way my life was. I left on another trip one time. Had a wife and 2 kids by then. And I wasn't a young guy. I was probably 28, 29 years old. I left Memphis, headed to Nashville with a cardboard suitcase in my pocket and about $3.75, which was enough to get me where I was going. Hitchhiking. Just crazy. Within a year, I had one of the best jobs in the city of Nashville in what I do for a living. And that's the way my life was. There was never any of this. When I got to living this way, I couldn't stand it. Now, I can stand chaos, and I cannot stand success. I mean, it's just a foregone conclusion that anything that looks like success. And when I get things going so good for me, just like the guy in the book, I get everything right where it looks like the next step is going to be the one that brings it all together, I'd tear it all down. Now, there's all those people that are depending on me to keep on building that thing, and I'm tearing it down around them. I guess the biggest lie I've ever told is an alcoholic, and maybe it may be our standard one big lie. Mutual lie. I don't know what they're worrying about. It's not hurting anybody but me. And I was killing everybody around me, strangers alike. You know, I did some terrible things in my life. I went through that area, you know, I mentioned the penitentiary to you, and I guess it could best be described as my gangster era. I didn't want to work. And I knew some people that didn't work looked like they were doing pretty dadgum good to me. So I kind of fell in with them, and I did some bad things to a lot of people. I hope I live long enough to make amends to all of them that I can. Wound up doing some time for that little thing. Got out of there, and there's a lot of funny stuff happened in my life. I had a lot of fun. But there were always 3 people, at least 3, sometimes more, and kind of in the shadows of my life that were not having near as much fun as I was. I was putting through living hell. You know, I have a son that's 10 years sober in our fellowship, thanks to you. I have a daughter who is determined, apparently, that she's going to be as crazy as I was. And she's damn near there. She's almost there. And you know, this sounds cold and harsh, but if she lives, we'll get her. See, that's what I have to pray for. She stays alive long enough for us to get her. So that's pretty much kind of the way my life was. I know it's kind of a jumbled up story, but I don't, you know, God bless them. They called me from Oklahoma City a number of years ago to come out there and talk at a deal. And they said, would you please send us a tape? I said, well, we got two problems here. I don't have one. And the second one is that if you had it, you may not get it when I get there. You know, I've tried doing it that way, and for some reason or another, I just can't do it. You see, I made a talk this morning in my bed between 5 and 6. It would absolutely put you in the floor. And I'm probably going to make one on that plane going home tomorrow. It'll be equally as good a talk. So I got up this morning, and I did, you know, I had all this stuff. I said, this is what I got to tell about this, I got to tell about that. Because, you know, early on in AA, I just knew that I was going to be the second coming to Clancy. I knew it. Now I ain't too sure that I'm glad it worked out like it did. Everything's fine. Everybody's got their own deal. 1976, this is where our story begins. Our story begins in 1976. I'd been drinking for 3 years without any success at all as far as alcohol doing for me what I wanted it to. I had given up 3 or 4 years prior to that a very difficult problem with outside issues in 1969. Somehow or another, I just put that stuff away in my life, but not so with the alcohol. I continued to drink, and I continued to become things that I detested in other people. I've kind of told you what my background was like. When I came in Alcoholics Anonymous in 1976, my outsides looked better than maybe they ever had in my life. I had a job, had 2 or 3 jobs, as a matter of fact. Both of my children were in the best parochial schools in Memphis. I lived in a good neighborhood. The police wasn't looking for me, and all my bills were paid. Hadn't been standing on street corners trying to look useful anymore in a long time. But I was absolutely dead inside. I was spiritually as bankrupt as I believe a human being can be. I didn't like looking in the mirror at all because I couldn't tolerate who I was looking at. So I drank a day at a time for almost 6 years with that in my heart and in my head. And I could not get up every morning thinking, and some mornings about 9:30 or 10, midway through that second half pint, I'd feel it, you know, that feeling that I got when I was 14 years old. It would come back momentarily, and then it would leave again. And the rest of the day, I just drank to kind of survive. And by 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night, I was more or less done for that day and got up the next day and started the process all over again. For some reason or other, my metabolism is such that I could consume huge quantities of alcohol and still stay on my feet most of the time. Occasionally, I'd get some of that, what they referred to in Arkansas as that sledgehammer whiskey. And just knocked me out, you know. And it didn't happen often, but when it did, man, I'm out. And I called a guy in November 1975. I'd been self-employed for about 5 years. And I wasn't a very good employee, kind of, you know. Had a crazy boss. He put up with a lot. I called this guy in the back of my mind. I said, well, if I can go back to work. See, I always took a great deal of pride about not working on the job. Well, yeah, how about that? The truth comes out sometimes when you're not even expecting it. I took a great deal of pride in not drinking on the job. I'm going to have to rethink this. I took such a great pride. I don't drink on the job, But what I failed to understand was I was so impaired the following day from what I had done the night before that I just, well, been drinking. And at that time, it was prior to the stoppage of the outside issues. I'd get a little help every morning when I woke up. And the help that I was using to wake you up really brought you alive. And, you know, you got to get up every morning in front of 25 or 30 or 40 salespeople and try to be a motivational force in their life for the day. And you've been on Printer's Alley in Nashville, Tennessee till 4 that morning. And it doesn't work good unless you got some help. So I'd take my help on the way to work in the morning and get all them guys fired up. And about 11 o'clock, that it's just die. And swear I'm never going to do this again. Next night would be the same thing over and over. Well, the last 6 years of my drinking, I couldn't escape myself. I couldn't get away from me. I could not get away from me. And I was fortunate enough, I called this guy and I said, Kenny, I'd like to go to work for you. And he said, what do you want to do? I said, I just want a salesman job. I don't want any responsibility. Not that they would give me any, but I said, I don't want any of that. Just put me on the team and let me come there and go to work as a salesman. He said, okay, when you want to start? This was about the 15th of November, 1975. I said, how about January the 3rd? Phone got kind of quiet, and he said, I've had some people give me some long notices when they were leaving here. But he said, man, that's a pretty long time between wanting to go to work and coming to work. I said, well, duck season's opening, and you know how I am about that. So I stayed drunk in a duck camp for about 2 months. And they grew a lot of outside issues on that island where I was. I can't tell you that. I'll tell you one thing. I did not diminish the waterfowl population. There were more ducks when I left than there were when I got there. Well, I came back to Memphis, and I didn't get back on the 3rd. I got back on the 16th of January with the firm resolve that I would not drink on the job. Well, we had our first sales meeting at 8 o'clock on a Monday morning. Got out of there about 8:30. We really got pumped up. I'm ready to go. And I went straight to my car and went about a mile and a half to the liquor store and got my first half pint for the day. First day. Couldn't make it through the first day with any resolve to that promise that I'd made myself. This has been going on about 10 days or 2 weeks. And I walked in one morning and there's still a little guy about this tall, sharp dresser, man. His little hair was white and he'd done put that blue shampoo on it where it shined. And his hair was a little blue. And I got to looking at him. I weighed 280 pounds, and I was about the color of that guy's shirt over there. Had that bourbon tan. Kept it all year. People said, man, you're awful red in the face. I said, I stay outside a lot. And, anyway, I looked at this little guy, and he said, he looked up at me. He said, you got any idea where we could get some breakfast? And I noticed he had that Ohio tone to his voice. For some reason or another, at that time, I don't know, I have no explanation for this. I didn't like little people. I don't know why. Don't ask me why. I was married to a little woman. Maybe that had something to do with it. Renee Towsley was about 5'7". Weighed 100 pounds, maybe. But he had the presence of a 300-pound gorilla in my life, I'll tell you. So he said, got any place we can eat breakfast? I said, yeah, as soon as this sales meeting's over, I'll show you. So I was wanting to get to the liquor store anyway. So this looked like a pretty good cover because they started noticing me leaving early in the morning. And so I took Renee up to the Shoney's on the corner and dropped him off. So where are you going? And You know, everybody's got nicknames for bottles and whiskey, at least we all did. And our nickname for a half a pint of whiskey was a pork chop. Somebody said, "Where are you going?" "So I'm going to go get a couple of pork chops. You want one?" So I dropped him off at that restaurant. He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going to run up the street and get me a pork chop. I'll be right back." He said, "They don't serve them in there." I said, "Not the kind I use. No, they don't." So I got that half pint and came back. He ate his breakfast, complained about the scrambled eggs. He said, "I ordered these things, soft scrambled. Here they are. I can't stand them." I'd been sober for 6 months, and we were still going in there every morning, and he's still ordering the same eggs. And the same thing's happening. I said, "Renee, why don't you order something else?" He said, "They're going to get these damn eggs right. I'm going to stay here with them until they do." This guy's 6 years sober, guys, when he's making them kind of comments. We don't get overnight success here. But anyway, I came back that morning. We shared. He ate breakfast. I knocked my little half pint out. He watched me do this for about 10 days or 2 weeks. I told Lou last night, I'm here as a textbook 12th step. The book says that we share with the prospective member of AA some humorous stuff, some tragic stuff about our lives. And he did that. He told me a story over about a 10-day period of time that so mirrored my life that I thought, this guy must have been following me for years. Except I'd never slept in that cardboard box in Chicago, Illinois, that he had. And I'd never been in a 43-day blackout that he'd been in. Got on the bus in Baltimore, Maryland, got off in Denver, Colorado 43 days later. He don't know where he was. He does. I'll say one thing for him. This little guy could make money, couldn't keep it. He did in this case. He got on that bus with a suitcase with about $10,000 in cash, and he still had the money when he got off in Denver when he came to. He started telling me all these stories, but more importantly about what he was doing and where it was happening, he's the first adult male that ever told me he had any fear. And I thought, my God, I'm not by myself. He started telling me about his feelings. And if you don't hear anything at all here this morning, that you can say, man, I don't have that guy's, you know, I don't identify with nothing he said. Hopefully I can convey a feeling or two to you that you can understand, because he started telling me how he felt while all this was going on in his life. And it was exactly the way I felt. Never mentioned anything about AA to me. Boy, he let me swallow the hook all the way down to my breastbone. He just kept feeding the lion to me. Finally, one day, I noticed that our employer was just, he'd say, "I got to be gone for a couple hours." I said, "Go ahead, man. Everything's cool." 3 or 4 nights a week, he'd say, "I got to leave a little early tonight." And they said, "That's fine." If I'd asked him the same thing, the answer would have been no. So I got real curious about it. I said, "Where do you go every day at noon?" He said, "It ain't really none of your business." I thought that was a little rude. And so I started saying, "Well, what about at night?" I said, "You cut out of here about 8 o'clock, 2 or 3 nights a week." He said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Oh, I go to prayer meeting on those nights." And, you know, if you'd have known Renee Towser, you'd have obviously known that was as big a lie as he could have ever told you. I said, "Man, you ain't going to prayer meeting." And so this went on for about another week. And finally, we're standing on a sunny February day, the 12th of February, 1976, on a Thursday, about 11 o'clock in the morning. And I said, "I want to know where you're going." And he said, "It looks like I'm going to have to tell you." He said, "Walt, I'm an alcoholic, and this time around, I've been going to AA for nearly 6 years without a drink, and I do it a day at a time." And I said something to him that morning that I don't believe I've ever said to anybody in my life at that time. I said, "You know, I might have a drinking problem myself." His reply to that was, "No, I don't believe you've had near enough to drink." Made me a lot. I thought, what the hell's wrong with this guy? I played that tape. And I said, well, maybe I've missed something here. I said, I've been drinking since about 7 this morning, and I'm going to probably finish it up about 10 tonight. I said, this is all going on in my mind. I'm trying to figure out how I could be drinking more. He said, I ain't had enough. I said, how are you going to drink any more than that? You'd have to stay up around the clock. So as he often did, he kind of read my mail, and he said, I know what you're thinking. He said, this is what I'm talking about. He said, you still got a job. You got a wife and 2 children. He said, you got some decent clothes. He said, they look like hell on you, but they're decent clothes. And he said, what you need to do, Walt? He said, you know where Third and Poplar is? I said, sure, that's where Jimmy Stroud's mission is down there. He said, you need to get down there behind Jimmy Stroud's mission with that bottle gang that I came off of, hustling for a pint of wine, and come back to me and tell me about your drinking problem. Now, is there any way to treat a newcomer? The next thing came out of my mouth shocked me. I almost fainted. I said, I'll tell you one thing, old man. He hated that. I already found that out about him. He didn't like to be called little either. I may have called him little old man. Because he made me hot telling me I hadn't had enough to drink. He said, I can't stop. Now, what about that? And when I said that, I thought, ooh, it's out of the bag now, ain't it? Your ego's like mine. Once you say that, it's hard to go back. He looked at me and he said, your problem may be a little more serious than I thought it was. He also looked at his watch, which I probably need to know. I've got a clock here. I may have 15 minutes left if y'all be tolerant of me. I know there's another phenomenon that takes place in AA, my sponsor told me. The phenomenon of craving leaves. And there's another phenomenon. If you talk longer than 45 minutes, everybody in the room goes deaf. So I'm going to try to do that. Anyway. He said, in about 15 minutes, I'm going to go to a meeting. And he said, you ain't going. Can you imagine a guy 12-stepping a prospective member of our fellowship in that manner? He said, the reason you're not going is because you've been drinking. And he said, you're not going to hear anything they have to say. And they do not want to hear anything you have to say. So he said, I'll tell you what you do. He called me Big Job from day one. I don't know where that came from, but I guess I looked like a large job to him. He said, I'll tell you what, Big Job. He said, you go ahead and finish your quota, whatever that is for the day. And he said, if you go Friday, Saturday, and Sunday without a drink, I'll consider taking you to a meeting. Well, they say that anger, you know, is better. We better let other people have that anger. In this case, helped me. I got so mad at that little old Yankee, I said, I'm going to show you something, pal. So I went home that night about 8:30, and I was in my regular shape, you know. And I thought, you know, I probably, being tomorrow, I'm going to have to make a change or two. I better get me a little more. So I got me another pint, and I didn't want to break my deal with him. For some reason or another, I was past being dishonest at that time, but I did not want to be dishonest with this guy. He had that much effect on me, one of us talking to another. I didn't want to break my word to him. I got that last pint of Old Charter down about 15 to 12, Thursday the 12th of February, 1976. Well, when I got up the next morning, wasn't no big deal. Hell, I was still drunk from the night before. I thought, this is going to be a cakewalk. Well, about 11 o'clock that morning, the cake started walking. Man, I thought, whoa, what have I done? Well, I got on through the first day, Friday. It happened to be Friday the 13th. I thought, boy, that adds some real meaning to this deal. I'm going to overcome Friday the 13th. Well, Saturday got things in. You know, there's a song called Stormy Monday Morning. God, it's a beautiful blues song. I wish I could sing it for you. It's what it says, stormy Monday, and Tuesday's just as bad. Thursday's worse, and Friday's oh so sad. Yeah, that's the way I felt Saturday. It got worse. Well, Sunday was a very difficult day for me in my early sobriety, and it was a very difficult day for me that weekend. Because, you see, I had a house full of whiskey. I like to keep it that way. I got nervous when it ran out. So Sunday, I didn't know anything about praying. To ask God to help me make it through that weekend was as foreign to me as anything I could imagine. And I got my hand on that cabinet two or three times that weekend and saw that whiskey there. And somehow or another, the thought of having to face this little Yankee jerk Monday morning and not have fulfilled that agreement, I couldn't stand it. I closed the door. God started taking care of me a long time before I learned to ask Him to do it. Went to work the following Monday, no drink. Got to work early. I can tell you that. I was up and early out of the house. There he stood. He said, "Well, you made it, didn't you?" I don't know why. I never asked him how he knew that. And I said, "Yes, I did." And I said, "Let's go to a meeting." He said, "You're going to have to wait till noon, man." Well, I'm ready to get in there. Wow. So, on the way to the meeting, we were about 20 minutes away from where we worked, and it was on the 14th floor of an office building, the Clark Tower building in Memphis, Tennessee. And I said, we got off the elevator, and I heard from me, you may differ with this, I heard from me, the most spiritual thing we do. Well, I can stand up here and talk to you about God all day long. But you take the laughter out of this room, and I'm going to go with it. I'm leaving with it. It's the most spiritual thing that happens in my life. We got off that elevator, and that room was probably as far as near the tree down the hall, and I heard them laughing, and the laughter had the same tone to it that it does here this morning. All the laughter I've been used to hearing, if there was any, was at someone else's expense. And there's a different sound to that. This was a sound of pure joy coming out of that room. Well, by the time we got there, I got kind of, hey, this may be okay. Well, I opened the door. It was a conference room set up probably to house me, maybe 15, 16 people for a business meeting. Well, there was about 40 of us in there smoking. You know, back then, everybody smoked, some of them two at a time. And, as shallow as that room was, you couldn't see some of the people in the back. The chairman sat up on the far end of the room. I barely could see him. So they said, "Come on in, man, have a cup of coffee." And everybody's laughing, talking. Some of them looked like they was a little bit ill, but by and large, everybody looked pretty happy. We sat down at that table. They had a newcomers meeting. Well, the time they got to me, and you got to understand, man, I'm weigh 280 pounds, and my body temperature today has changed so much. I'm sitting there sweating and crying, couldn't talk. I cried for the first 5 years I'm in AA. I'm probably going to cry before I leave here this morning. But I found out one thing, you don't care, and I don't either. And God sure doesn't care. So anyway, they went around that room and they shared some stuff with me, and I walked out of that room and we went back to work. He said, "Good things happen to drunks that don't drink." I kind of listened to that. We got out of the car, and I've been on, in our business, we refer to it as a slick spot when sales are not going all that well. I got out of the car and he said, "Why don't you wait on that guy out there?" I walked over to this guy. I said, "Yes, sir, could I help you?" He said, "How much is this 1976 LTD coupe?" And I told him. He said, "I'll take it." I thought, damn, this thing works quick. No. I'm already getting results. I ain't been to but one meeting. Well, from there on, he told me about going to a meeting every day and suggested that. He says, "It's not written down anywhere. It's just a suggestion." Of course, my first thought to that was, I ain't going to have time to go to all them meetings. I made the mistake of telling him that. And he came back with a very logical reply. He said, how many hours a day do you drink? Kind of blew that 1 hour a day of recovery out the window. So somehow or another, I managed, I don't know, by the grace of God, to go to two meetings a day for the better part of the next 3 years. And God was kind enough to keep me more or less in that pink, fluffy stuff for that long. There were some bad things happened to me. I had an experience with my daughter during that period of time. It was extremely painful. But by the time 3 years had rolled around, you see, I'd been married to this gal for 25 years by that time. And the reason I can't tell this part of my story because it's her story and it has some things involved in it that I have no business discussing with you. But let's just leave it this way. When we married in 1953, there was not a pregnancy involved, but it was the last thing in the world I wanted to do. And we stayed in that marriage, and I was a terrible husband and a terrible father. And 3 years into this deal, I sobered up. We've been married to a lady now that I mentioned to you earlier. I used to be reluctant to share this because I didn't want to miss an opportunity in case I changed my mind. I had never cheated on this girl in 28 years. I'm very thankful to you for that, and she is as well. 1987, I'm a three-pack of smoke a day guy. Got up one morning and I said, God, you know, I'm about ready to hang this stuff up. And I hate to come to you with such a trivial problem, but help me, please help me not smoke a day at a time. Within a week, the desire to smoke left me. Within 30 days after coming into AA, I think the desire to drink left me to my first meeting. To tell you that I didn't think about drinking after that would not be the truth. But that overwhelming compulsion and urge that I had to drink was gone, and it's never come back. There's so much I'd like to tell you about our story, and I've jacked around here talking about some crazy stuff, and I'm going to take about 5 minutes of your time, if you will, and tell you that every promise in that book has come true to me tenfold. My life just keeps getting fuller by the moment. I took enough outside issues and drank enough alcohol to kill everybody in this room, and I'm not trying to impress you with that. When I stopped smoking, I got involved with something that I had done as a young man, started running again, and I'd be out there 5 or 6 miles, 60 years old, and the thoughts of what I had put my body through and what it was still capable of doing absolutely overwhelms me, the grace of God. I keep coming to you. I sponsor people on a regular basis. Right now I got me about 3 or 4, and they're... three of them are about ready to leave the nest. You know, my first sponsor had a whole lot of problem turning loose of his babies when they got ready to go. And sometimes I do. But I got 2 or 3 of them now. Their lives have come together. They're starting to spend a lot of time with their families rather than us hooked to the joint at the hip on a daily basis. Sometimes it makes me a little sad, but it's the best thing for me and them. I've had such a great time this weekend. You know, I stand here and I'm able to look at the face of God. People sometimes ask me today, why do you still go to that deal? And my thoughts are, how in the world could you stop going to this? How could you stop coming to this? Where I can't imagine being anywhere else Sunday morning, September the 30th of 2007, and having an opportunity that comes anywhere near what you've given me this morning to look you in the eye and try my best to tell you a story that maybe you'll take with you someday and say, you know, if that nut could do it, you know, so could I. So could I. I want to thank you again from the bottom of my heart for being here. Thank you for your laughter. You know, I'm sorry I can't sing, but it's just one of them things. And I'm not making light of Angie at all. She did a great job last night, and I sat there and cried like a baby. But thanks again for having me.